Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in men and women in the United States. 1/4 of all deaths in Alaska each year are due to heart disease. Which one of us is at risk for heart disease, and how can we improve these statistics? Our phone numbers in Anchorage are 550-8422. Our outside toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. However, I want to point out, right now, we're not in phone contact with you, so use our email address if you've got questions at line1@aprn.org. Coming up next hour, our topic is preventive cardiology.
Today's program is underwritten in part by The Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescriptions, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of satellites in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign. Providence, Alaska combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
Welcome to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today's topic is preventative cardiology. I'll give our phone numbers out a little later, but right now we're having telephone problems. So if you've got questions or comments, email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, in all one word, line1@aprn.org. My guest today is Dr. Christopher Dyke of the Alaska Heart Institute here in Anchorage, and he's the co-director of the Healthy Hearts Program. Before we get started, I just want to mention that next week's program will be discussing how health information gets distorted, who distorts the information, and why they might want to do that. My guest will be Dr. Jeffrey Cabot. He's the author of Hyping Health Risks, Environmental Hazards in Daily Life, and the Science of Epidemiology. Dr. Dyke, welcome to Line One.
Thank you.
Let's define preventive cardiology.
Well, as a cardiologist, I would say virtually every patient I see, prevention is addressed. Now, the difference is the type of patient that we see. The majority of patients we see in cardiology already have a diagnosis of heart disease. By definition, these patients are at high risk. For example, high risk are those patients who, over a 10-year period, have a 20% chance of having another heart attack or dying from a heart attack. Very clear cut. And as you know, very few things in medicine are that black and white. Mm-hmm. So those patients we label as secondary prevention. We're essentially trying to prevent their second or third or fourth heart attack. Now, the larger population that exists are those patients without heart disease, but they're at risk for heart disease, and we label that primary prevention. And what prevention clinics are geared to do is to address risk for heart disease in this subset of patients, virtually those patients without known heart disease.
So this is a paradigm. You've got a program started with yourself, the Heart Institute, and with Providence together.
Yeah, we're partnered with Providence.
And this is an idea that has been initiated and started in other medical centers and being somewhat reproduced locally.
Correct. A couple of the cardiologists that have recently relocated to Anchorage trained in institutions, specifically Duke University and Johns Hopkins, where prevention is a key focus as part of their cardiovascular program. And I think as we're kind of finally getting our arms around treatment of heart disease, we're now branching out and really affecting those people that are at risk, those people that we'll eventually see, and trying to reduce that risk over time.
You know, constantly in the program, I'm asking people to think about what's the risks and what's the benefits. So I want to be kind of crass here and say, okay, so we got this preventative program out there. What's the evidence that it works? You know, do we know that this is a reasonable thing to expect to make change with?
We clearly know. It's very convincing for decades now that by addressing individual risk factors and those risk factors that are very important in the development of heart disease. And just to kind of outline those now while we're talking about it, I like to categorize risk factors into those we can change and those we can't change. The factors we can't change are very straightforward, basically, our family history, so our kind of genetic makeup, what we're pre-programmed to do, and age. As we get older, the risk of heart disease increases. We haven't found the fountain of youth yet, and we haven't done genetic therapy per se yet, but I would say over the next century or two, we'll probably see some development there. So right now, we can't change much of that. But the other risk factors, the important risk factors for heart disease, including high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, smoking, and then including other lifestyle things such as diet and exercise, are very important. And we know that by addressing those individual risk factors, those that we can change, we can reduce heart disease. For example, if we take a simple measure such as blood pressure and we reduce blood pressure by just 10 points, that risk on a population level reduces the burden of heart disease, heart attacks, by 20%. So if we can identify those risks up front, we can treat those risks, we know we can reduce it.
Let's also back up just a little bit, and we're talking about primarily coronary artery disease, atherosclerotic heart disease. Is that, I mean, when we say heart disease, there's genetic heart disease, there's some structural heart disease, but so let's define that, and then let's, if you don't mind, tell me what's going on in the arteries, what leads to the problems, what's the consequences?
Great, and that's a great point. I'm glad you brought that up, because we see and treat a lot of diseases in cardiology, and when we talk about heart disease, we're basically talking about what we call atherosclerosis. We call it coronary plaquing, and it's basically those blockages that build up over time, composed mostly of cholesterol and fat, that put us at risk for having heart attacks. Now, the whole mechanism, which is a very important and key point that I like to highlight to patients, the mechanism that causes heart attacks are varied, but the one that really highlights the challenge of what we face in cardiology are the plaques, the blockages that aren't significant, but yet are still what we call vulnerable to causing a heart attack. So there's this whole concept we have called the vulnerable plaque. That plaque is basically a very complex and dynamic process. It's not as simple as just cholesterol building up over time. And I would say the classic misconception that most patients have, and even some health providers, is that heart attacks don't occur because blockages just build up over time and then a heart attack happens. At the level of the plaque, something happens where it cracks open. I kind of relate it to like an earthquake just for people to visualize. So it fissures and it ruptures and it exposes all that really gooey cholesterol and fat substance to circulating cells. And those circulating cells are there basically to repair that process. Just like if you were to cut yourself, for example, you're going to form a scab and then a scar. That same process goes on inside our bodies and inside our arteries. And that process can be counterproductive. These cells we call platelets that form the initial layer over that crack can build up, and in the right setting, if they're kind of ramped up to do that, they can actually totally block the artery, and that's what causes a heart attack. So the scary thing here is that you can actually have an angiogram, which is a procedure where we go in, we look at the arteries, very invasive, and it's really our gold standard for saying whether or not we have heart disease. And if there are no significant blockages there, nothing we can treat mechanically with a balloon or a stent or bypass surgery, we then manage the patient. Again, lifestyle is really kind of the backbone of our treatment strategies, but with medications to help reduce that risk over time and address risk factors. But the scary part here is, say I did an angiogram in someone and they had various degrees of blockages, and even up to what we consider significant, which is 75%. And that marker of 75% is there because it limits blood flow down the artery to the muscle that exists beyond that blockage, and it causes harmful effects or symptoms, chest pain, breathing problems, and so forth. If we let that go, which there is data actually to manage these areas conservatively, a trial published last year called the COURAGE trial, which is a separate subject. But for example, there's various degrees of blockages. Somebody comes in 2 weeks later with a heart attack, not even a Vegas odds maker can say which of those plaques caused the problem. Mm-hmm. And that's where really we have a paucity of data. We have a lack of information and understanding about how best to manage overall risk. So we can reduce risk. Mm-hmm. And that's where prevention can be a little bit of a misnomer if you take it at its absolute name, in that it's not 100%. There are definitely factors, and this most important factor with the vulnerable plaque and the rupture and the clot formation is really a scary phenomenon. And I think if, as a cardiologist, most of us think if we can understand that process and identify people as that risk factor, we would have found the holy grail of cardiology, because that is really why people die from heart attacks, and it still is our number one killer.
Well, I have a number of questions, but before we do, let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. We, as you know, would be more than happy to take your calls and questions. The telephones are not working at this time, so email us, line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at aprn.org, if you have questions or comments about what you're hearing today. Let me, as I understand it, you're exactly right. I mean, it's a much different paradigm of heart disease than I was trained in with the 70s, not the 30s. I was thinking 30, 40 years ago, where it was a slow narrowing and you got heart disease because of that. And if you developed slowly over time, you didn't die of a heart attack. If it happened acutely, you died. And I don't think we were thinking at that time, or I don't recall being told about these sudden thromboses that happen. But let's use an example that is rather tragic, and that's Tim Russert. Tim was a moderator of Meet the Press, was on NPR for a number of years, and had high blood pressure, had some cholesterol issues, but was regularly being seen, and then suddenly died of a heart attack. His story has been published. It was in the June 24th, 2008 New York Times, but I think it serves as a good example from which to work with, that you can do everything right, but preventative cardiology, the world's greatest cardiologist, can't guarantee what's going to happen. And so if we could expand on his story, maybe it'll help get this point across. That you're
definitely. Trying. No, I think he is a very poignant example, and almost a poster child, if you will. And I think that's why the information has been so forthcoming about his condition, about who he was seeing from a cardiology perspective and the testing that he had undergone. And he's a poster child in that he definitely had risk factors for heart disease. He was struggling with a syndrome we call the metabolic syndrome, where he had a waist circumference greater than 40 inches. He had lipid or blood cholesterol abnormalities, and he struggled with some borderline diabetes issues. And I think you put that into the mix. We talk about this birds of a feather flock together. Well, these things aren't just simply additive. They can be multipliers, basically. And when you find a constellation like that, this is a very high-risk individual. And despite all the testing that we can do today, and despite all the lifestyle changes, which he was actually a participant in, it's a really important distinction, and despite the way that his disease processes were contributing to this, he still had a heart attack and died from his heart attack as a complication from a rhythm problem that is the frequent way that people die suddenly from a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And I think his story tells us and humbles us that we don't have all the answers, and that we need to keep looking, and we need to identify those people that are at risk for this problem and develop strategies to really figure out how best to manage these. Because Tim Russert is somebody who actually underwent stress testing, which we think is a way for us to try and figure out if someone has significant blockages or not. And it also speaks to the point where he probably didn't have significant blockages, but he definitely had a blockage problem, an atherosclerosis problem, and one of these plaques ruptured and then caused his untimely death.
Mm-hmm. So when these clots rupture, our natural inflammatory system responds to these chemicals and thinks something bad's going on as a consequence, and really all disease is a consequence to a large degree of our body responding to injury, caused an acute block. So, bam, suddenly there's a dam in that coronary artery and everything downstream does not get any blood supply. And his problem was he knocked out enough of his heart muscle and his conduction system. He had an arrhythmia, and that was it. And maybe a defibrillator were to work, maybe aspirin at the time. I mean, these are issues I think we ought to flesh out. But that's basically the story of what happened. Despite good care, despite doing everything that's right, we're not at that point where we can predict everything by any means.
Correct. And I think that's a very scary place to be. But it also puts our attention on doing the right things and trying to control the risk. And, you know, I'm trained as an academician and was on faculty and actually coordinated clinical trials. So I think anecdotes are important for us to learn by, but aren't the rule necessarily. Right. And so it's not to say that, you know, don't do all the right things because, you know, for this one person that had this unfortunate event, there are 99 other people that by doing these things actually did live longer and had fewer heart attacks.
Yeah, it's one of the things that is important to understand. We're much more affected by anecdotes, but the fact is if we can decrease the plaque, if we can increase decrease the risk factors, then the likelihood of these things happening decrease. They don't come to zero.
Right, right. Well, I think human nature is you're always looking for a way to rationalize not having to go out there and work on the treadmill or you know, watch your diet closer. And if you see these things happen to somebody who's doing all the right things, it can be a little counterproductive. We do have very good data, very strong data to say that we can reduce your risk over time if we implement and we control risk factors. And that's really all we can do. There's a lot of other factors. This is a very complicated disease process that contribute. And it's impossible to really control every single one of these 100%.
Well, let's enumerate very succinctly. We've kind of talked around on the risk factors. Maybe I'll ask you to start at the highest risk factor you can think of and work down. Because at some point I was going to ask, okay, what's the real – give me the bottom line here. But probably can't be done. But what's the number one risk factor you'd say that you worry about the most?
Well, I think it would depend on the age of the patient that's coming to see me.
Okay.
If it's a younger person, the one I worry about the most is family history.
Okay.
If someone's had a father or mother, specifically first-degree relative, who has had a premature heart attack, and by premature we generally mean men before 45, women before 55. If they've had a heart attack in that range and it wasn't brought on by something else, something they did, for example, then this person probably has some yet unidentified genetic problem that makes them maybe more vulnerable to these plaques rupturing, cracking, and causing things. Or maybe their whole inflammatory cascade is just Superman and just gets really revved up and contributes to this whole process. So that's really the most alarming thing when a young patient comes in. And family history is very important. But if there's a family history of a grandfather who had a heart attack at age 80, I don't, you know, get too excited about it because age is probably the next big one. As we get older, this whole process of plaques forming in these arteries increases. And we know it starts at a very early age. Veterans from the Korean War that came back as autopsy series, we saw this streaking of the process of atherosclerosis as early as age 18. So we know this is an early phenomenon, and it only increases over time. And that process is generally a stable process as it increases, but at any point in time, it can become unstable. And if symptoms come on dramatically, I think that's an important distinction. If someone has new symptoms or their symptoms are increasing or occur at rest, we call that an unstable coronary syndrome, and people should seek medical management from the ER as soon as possible via 911. But getting back to talking about important risk factors, I do think family history and age are probably the most important. Unfortunately, those are the ones we can't really control very well. but identifying them makes us more aggressive in how we treat those patients specifically.
Let me stop right now, because this age issue is an important one, and you've implied an obvious question is some people may form clots, and this is an oversimplification, much easier, and there are, we know, genetic syndromes where that happens. So what I'm hearing you say, and what I want to make sure is correct, is if you have a strong family history, particularly first-degree relatives, really relatively young people having heart attacks, that is a really important person to be seen, to be screened for some of these issues. Is that the
correct
point? So that's independent of weight, independent of exercise, independent of smoking. This is a separate issue that I don't think maybe a lot of people are quite as aware of.
Right. I think it's really important to pay attention to your family tree, to ask those questions and to understand what had happened to different family members. Because I think the earlier we can initiate those things, and there probably are some risk factors that we don't screen for in a population level because it's not very prevalent. But, for example, if somebody has a marker, one of these kind of lipid cholesterol markers that is not as prominent or prevalent in the society, but it may put them at risk, we may screen for that. So there are a set of screening tests that I go through with people that have family history of heart disease that I may not do in somebody who's 65 and coming to my office for an evaluation.
Okay.
But moving on in terms of risk factors, I think they're all, as we move on, probably equally important with the possible exception of diabetes. And I do want to highlight diabetes because diabetes has been labeled as a coronary risk equivalent. Now, that term basically means that diabetics have the same risk of having a heart attack as someone who's already had a heart attack. They're in that high-risk category. There was a study published that basically documented that. Their risk is identical over a seven-year period. And diabetics with heart disease have an even more dramatic risk of heart attacks, up to 30% over a 10-year period. So I think diabetes is the one kind of game changer. And as we're kind of addressing this near global, or at least U.S. epidemic of obesity and diabetes, moving forward, it's going to be really important to make sure we're addressing that with the right measures, including lifestyle, and how we can best manage these people to prevent cardiovascular disease.
And that cardiac equivalent, I don't forget the term you used exactly, is the same whether it's type 1 or type 2 diabetes.
Correct.
Okay. Correct. All right. So we're family history, age, diabetes.
And then, you know, cholesterol is important, of course. I mean, if you think about the mechanism behind why people develop plaque, I mean, it's cholesterol-based. And if we think about the impact that certain medications have made in cardiology, specifically the statins, they've probably been the most effective at reducing risk over time compared to the other things we use on a chronic disease basis. High blood pressure, clearly very important. And then we get into lifestyle things like smoking and lack of exercise and people not following the correct diets.
One of the things that appears to be happening is that the incidence, and I may be taking my terms wrong, and the death rate or the diagnosis, it seems to be slowly beginning to decrease. Do we have ideas about why that is? Is it medical input? Is it lifestyle changes? Is it something else?
So, yeah, cardiovascular mortality has at least plateaued and is decreasing, and I think it's probably mostly because of medical-based therapies.
Okay.
I don't think the U.S. is to the place where we've really implemented lifestyle successfully.
Yeah. In fact, we're going the wrong way.
I think we're definitely going to the wrong way. I mean, the emphasis we have right now on computers and video games and so forth is really, again, starting from a very young age moving forward, I think disastrous in terms of cardiovascular health implications.
Okay. You haven't mentioned weight. I mean, we've kind of beat around weight and exercise. I was surprised, and I guess I'm somewhat gratified they weren't up on the top list. I really appreciate the young age issue, and genetics is an important issue. But and smoking. We certainly are decreasing. We're seeing less smoking, although there's some of us that may be plateauing, unfortunately, as well. And I was going to – just naturally, it makes sense to think, well, maybe that has something to do with a decrease in heart disease.
speaking of weight, I mean, I think weight can be a significant factor. The weight is a little bit more confusing, though, to really tease out.
Okay.
And what we found is that if weight as a marker, meaning where the weight exists, where the fat exists, and if it's kind of that Homer Simpson look, you know, that pot belly kind of beer gut kind of thing, that look is what we call the metabolic syndrome as one of those defining characteristics. And a truncal obesity for men greater than 40 inches and women greater than 35 inches puts them at risk for this syndrome of we call a metabolic syndrome. There are other factors that go with that. There's usually a high triglyceride, a kind of borderline diabetes, what we call glucose intolerance, and a low HDL. And those factors really are a very high-risk patient. I was always kind of humbled when I did my cardiology fellowship at Duke and cathed a lot of people, and they eat a lot of barbecue in North Carolina, as you may know, and there were some large people, and it was really those large people that had this kind of metabolic look, and this is pre-definition of metabolic syndrome, that were really more riddled with heart disease than just somebody who was really overweight. Having said that, being overweight does put you at risk for these risk factors we've already talked about, which is high blood pressure, diabetes, and a high cholesterol. And if weight does contribute to those problems, then it becomes a bigger issue.
Okay. So it's an additive factor that needs to be considered. Same with smoking?
Smoking is a huge risk factor, and I think it's, you know, we always give lip service to it, but I think it's underappreciated when it comes to these what we call acute myocardial infarctions or people coming in with heart attacks. Because the tobacco and the tar that gets in the system has a way of making clots more easy to form. And it really contributes to that whole injury pattern where we see the cracking of the plaque and then the cascade of effects. And, you know, that would be a very relatively straightforward approach in terms of reducing the risk of heart disease is if we could just have people stop smoking.
Okay. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. You could call us, except our phones are not working. So keep an open eye for our ear, at least, to listening to us. In the meantime, if you have questions or comments, I want you to email us, please, at line1@aprn.org. After this break, we'll continue to take your email messages and continue our conversation with Dr. Christopher Dyke of the Alaska Heart Institute. On Line 1, your health connection, I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1, your health connection, comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Providence Imaging Center, providers of digital mammography, breast ultrasound, and MRI. Service information online at provimaging.com. The Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance has a simple request. If you smoke, take it outside. Smoking hurts more than just you. Secondhand smoke increases the risk of coronary heart disease and kills nearly 50,000 non-smoking Americans every year. Smoking around your kids causes chronic and life-threatening diseases and is linked to sudden infant death syndrome. So if you choose to smoke, make a choice that protects others who don't. Take it outside. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is Line 1, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're speaking with Anchorage cardiologist, preventive cardiologist, Dr. Christopher Dyke, about preventative cardiology. If you would email your questions to us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at aprn.org. And I'm told that we now can take some phone calls, so 550-8422 is the number. And if you're outside of Anchorage, we have a toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. Please remember, if you're listening to Line 1 between 8 and 9 p.m. Monday night, you're listening to a recorded broadcast, so we won't be available at that time. Let's take a couple of phone calls. There's a number of questions I still have in my mind about this plaque development, and maybe just as a way of summary to make sure I'm understanding what's going on, really now where this plumbing, these coronary arteries are slowly getting occluded from a number of factors related to obesity, genetics, diabetes, and so forth. But what really gives us problems is this sudden breaking, disturbing of the plaque, which turns into it turns on our clotting system and causes a sudden clot. And that's where the issue of a sudden heart attack is. And no matter how well you've been looked at, how well you've been studied, that is an unpredictable thing at this point. One call in from Matt Clayman or an email is, what's the current recommendations of aspirin and why is he asking that question?
Well, I think we knew the answer about aspirin. Mm-hmm. It's one of those few issues where I think most cardiologists would say without any doubt that aspirin is important. And but that question is evolving. But I do want to backstep just one second here and say that, again, we're addressing primary prevention. So basically people who have not been diagnosed with heart disease. Aspirin is 100% indicated for people with known heart disease. And so I really want to emphasize that point here. So the comments that are being addressed now moving forward are basically those for primary prevention. We had a lot of task force, a lot of data dating back years, but really well published in the early 2000 era that said primary prevention using aspirin is safe and important in certain populations. But we're having evolving data over the past year that has really kind of questioned whether or not aspirin is useful for everybody in primary prevention. And the reason is aspirin is clearly effective for reducing heart attacks, even in a primary prevention setting. The problem is...
By preventing clots.
Exactly.
Preventing the clots, okay.
Well, Annie, we're not exactly sure. We think that's a component to it. Aspirin inhibits something we call cyclooxygenase, which is something that works on platelets. And so it basically makes those platelets less sticky and less able to form clot. The other thing is it is an anti-inflammatory mechanism, so it may kind of have a multiplicity of effects. But the problem with aspirin, as you probably know, is that it does increase our bleeding risk, and specifically GI bleeding. And so when you balance the positive effects with aspirin in reducing heart attacks with the side effects of GI bleeding and so forth, it's a wash. It's not harmful. But in terms of its overall effectiveness, it's kind of a wash. Mm-hmm. So, and I urge everyone to talk with their doctor before changing, but that is becoming in question in terms of which treatment populations from a primary prevention require aspirin. And the U.S. Preventative Task Force actually made some recommendations earlier this year which basically take an age range approach to primary prevention using aspirin for men and women. So men 45 to 80 and women 55 to 80 as the acceptable range. But other people are saying that even within that range, there are other populations that may have more side effects than benefit. And there are some trials that are actually in progress right now and that will have more data in the future to really clarify the role of aspirin in primary prevention.
This is exactly, in my mind, analogous to the recent recommendations by the same body about screening film mammography in breast cancer that caused so much concern. And the fact that what we're talking about is at some point the risks outweigh the benefits and we're constantly honing in on which groups. But the bottom line is you need to individually decide with your physician what's the safest, what's the risk benefit for you,
correct,
not this group of people.
Right. Most of our studies are done on a population.
Right.
It's usually a given population, so you kind of have to look at how those studies were performed and who they were performed in. But definitely, before any of these decisions are made, in consultation with your physician is the best approach.
Okay, so the recommendation for aspirin is it depends.
Well, the recommendation is for those with heart disease, it is 100% indicated.
Uh-huh.
For those that are at risk for heart disease, there are potential benefits, and those benefits versus side effects should be addressed by your physician.
All right, here's an email, more of a complaint than anything. A woman saying she's got a friend, 6'2", 235, about 30 pounds overweight, high blood pressure, is diagnosed as being borderline diabetic, has a sedentary job. It's been evaluated, but nobody said, hey, lose weight, cut down on animal fats, get regular exercise, suggesting some common sense. So she's saying maybe somebody's not getting the message out there, professional-wise, physician-wise.
Well, yeah, I'm a little surprised to hear that. You know, anecdotally, you know, there may have been something that slipped through the cracks. But I think we're really focused, and especially our primary care doc community here is very focused. I've been very impressed with the referrals I get in that they've really worked up people well. I mean, they're screening for these things. They're trying to address risk. When I talk to them, they say that they've you know, they've been told the right things. But the goal behind this prevention clinic that we're starting is basically to address risk in this type of patient, where we can basically have this patient have a panel of blood work done and some imaging tests to kind of look at their risk and then meet in consultation with a physician, with an exercise physiologist to talk about working out exercise options for lifestyle and a dietitian.
Mm-hmm. We got a number of emails, some of which we've kind of talked about, so I'm going to pick and choose because I don't know if we'll get through all of them, and I want to let those people who have taken the time to email know that. But I also want to talk briefly about statins. You've mentioned statins. What is it that statins do? How do they affect the risk? And also risk of subsequent heart attack and heart disease, but also what's the risk of the statins?
Great question. This is a very, I won't say controversial subject, but because the data is incredibly clear. Mm. It is, I think, the most important medication in cardiology. Okay. I mean, it's addressing the pathophysiology of why we have heart disease, and it lowers heart disease more than anything. But the community swell, and whether this has to do with all the caveats that get put on commercials or with talking with other patients or from their physician or reading things on the internet is the concern of side effects of statin. Mm-hmm. But I always ask my patients, what's the side effect of not taking a statin? Right. And I really try and highlight not only the heart protection effects of statins, but also the stroke protection effects of statins. And that usually gets their attention. Mm-hmm. Most people know people that have had heart attacks and they're walking and talking and doing fine, but most people also know people with strokes and they're not so fortunate sometimes. But statins are basically medications that lower cholesterol. They're very powerful. They lower the component of cholesterol we call the low-density lipoprotein, which is LDL. It's the bad cholesterol. And all of our guidelines right now that exist are predicated on the LDL cholesterol. I think most people know their total cholesterol, and that's an important number to know. But really, that LDL is the target on the basis of risk. So if somebody has heart disease, their LDL targets are maybe less than somebody who just has one or two risk factors for heart disease. Statins are important in that they manage the cholesterol in our body, but they also have been shown that when they're initiated, they can cause some plaque regression. There's been some studies, very invasive studies, that have documented with a technique called intravascular ultrasound plaque regression on the basis of taking some of these more potent statins. And I think there probably is some component to stabilizing plaque, although that's just purely hypothetical at this point.
Making it less likely to crack.
Correct.
Okay.
But if you look at almost every statin trial done, it's a positive trial. Mm-hmm. And many of those trials were stopped early for protective benefit.
Because there's so much benefit, you didn't want the group not getting it.
Exactly, yeah. Each of these trials,
ethically, it had to be stopped.
Yeah. Each of these trials has a safety committee reviewing that data. And we as cardiologists often joke that we should put statins in the water, just like fluoride, for public health.
So it's not that it's not beneficial and that they're not risk. It's always a balance. What's the risk of doing it? What's the risk of not doing it? Which we've kind of harped on in this program, which I think is an appropriate way to think about it. But for each individual, again, it may, that risk-benefit ratio is what you need to talk to somebody
correct
about.
And I think the goal here, statins probably have what we call a pleiotropic effect, or there's probably more to it than meets the eye. I mean, we measure things with an LDL cholesterol, but it has all these other positive mechanisms with that have to deal with what we call our vascular tone and some other very key measures that would probably help improve this whole coronary disease process. But obviously that has to be balanced with the risks. And I always outline those risks to patients. The biggest risk we worry about is the risk of liver toxicity. Mm-hmm. And even with high-dose statins, that risk is probably no more than 3%. But that's why we measure liver tests in patients before and after starting therapies. But the big complaint that most people have is that they feel achy. You know, they have body aches and so forth. And statins can cause what we call a myopathy, where there is actual kind of injury to muscle. And there, it's a very complex phenomenon and cascade for how and why it does this. Very difficult to prove unless they actually have inflammation of these muscles, which we can measure through a simple blood test. But you'll hear people say that, and the problem is the treatment population that we treat in generally kind of has some aches and pains.
Yeah.
And again, people sometimes look for a way to mm-hmm. not have to take a medication.
Right.
My urging is just to at least give it a shot, and if it doesn't work, there are other solutions out there. So working with a physician just to make sure that LDL cholesterol is managed to goal is the most important prerogative.
So I'm hearing that statins are a very, very important addition to the armamentarium. Maybe they stabilize plaques. Most particularly, they improve the plaque, may decrease the size. So the question that comes to my mind is, what else might decrease the plaque? Does diet help? What kind of diet? What else can we do? Because we want to know.
I'd like to know, too.
Okay. All right.
We don't have the same kind of data that we do for statins because these statin trials were done in a very controlled setting.
Okay.
It's very difficult to take somebody on a diet and say, I'm going to put this catheter down your coronary artery. And, yeah, it might cause a heart attack, but we really want this information.
Yeah.
My guess is that by changing whatever cholesterol profile that exists in that body, you'll probably – maybe not regress the plaque, but you'll at least slow the progression. And I think that's, and maybe even change the composition. And I think that's really the bottom line. What we've learned through the years is that really lifestyle is a backbone, and adding certain medications is what saves lives.
We talked briefly about diets before we came on the air, and perhaps since we're all battling weight loss, and or many of us, including myself, and because it's such an important issue in pediatrics, which is at the beginning of this whole preventive thing, what can you share with us about the effectiveness and the kinds of approaches we should be taking to diet?
Well, I think our biggest problem is portion control. And I think if we solved that problem, we'd probably make a huge dent in the whole obesity epidemic and diabetes and heart disease. But specifically talking about the types of food to eat, there are two diets that have been proven in the scientific literature to be beneficial in reducing events from a cardiovascular perspective, namely heart attacks and dying from heart attacks. And the first is one we call the Mediterranean diet, which is basically an emphasized diet of seafood, of nuts, and cooking in olive oil. And the nice thing about the Mediterranean diet is you can add some carbs, you know, a little pasta and so forth, and a glass of red wine. That's not all of it, but that's kind of the simple overview. So a pretty tasty outlook for those people that don't have necessarily obesity problems. With those that do and struggle with that, and even a borderline diabetic or frank diabetes approach, I tend to recommend the other diet that's been proven, and that's the South Beach diet, which has gotten a lot of press and has been very successful. And essentially, the way I look at it is it's a Mediterranean diet, but with a low-carb edge. So you're really kind of watching that carbohydrate input. If people eat carbs, and they don't exercise that energy gained from the carbs off. It basically goes to our midsection, and that's the goal here. And I always talk about diet in concert with exercise. I think it's really difficult to lose weight or address these risk factors and obesity's contribution to each risk factor without having the two work together.
There's an email that asks about smoking and risk and whether a single cigarette is an increase, and then also another question that asks about are we talking about smokeless tobacco adding to the risk as well?
Well, smokeless tobacco may have its own problems, but it doesn't get into the bloodstream through the lungs and directly to the heart like it does when you inhale tobacco. And one cigarette may be enough. I mean, there may be enough in that to you know, if the setting is right. Clearly, the more you smoke, the more you are at risk. But the single cigarette has the same components to the multiple cigarettes that people have their heart attacks from.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about cholesterol. We've mentioned LDLs as a risk factor. A question comes in and says, I want to raise my HDL. And the way I remember that is that stands for highly desirable.
Lipid. That's right. It's a great way to remember it. I'm going to use that.
This person wants to raise theirs. He's a non-smoker. Zocor, it says, helped a little. Flushing happened with a niacin derivative. So anything else to suggest about raising the highly desirable?
So, yeah, HDL is highly desirable because it's cardioprotective.
Okay.
We know that people that have high HDLs have a less incidence of heart attacks. And so there are very few things we can do to raise our HDL. Probably the most important is exercise. Exercise can improve our vascular tone and in general improves our HDL component to the total cholesterol. Smoking is a very negative HDL effect. So in those that do smoke, I know this listener doesn't smoke, but for those that do smoke, smoking cessation is very important for increasing the HDL. And then outside of that, it's basically just medical therapy. And probably the most potent are the niacins. And niacin is just it's a B vitamin, but we give it in pretty large doses and large enough that it does cause some symptoms. And the biggest is flushing. I don't know if this listener tried one of the newer compounds, but some of the newer compounds are hoped to reduce that flushing side effect in a way that they are more long-acting and they don't get this huge rush. So if you go out to Costco and buy niacin, it'll be basically a short-acting niacin compound. There are different preparations that are longer-acting. And there are prescription compounds that are the longest acting, and they've been the most successful. And then there's one other compound called a fibrate, which there are many different ones that can increase HDL as well as lower triglycerides.
Another question or an email that I'm reading through here is really kind of gets to the issue of it can be confusing from a family history standpoint about what to do. And this particular individual says, my family history is not good. Everyone seems to have high cholesterol and triglycerides. They've had a sister who had a early age heart attack, yet her grandmother is 94 and lives alone, yet had a cholesterol in her 300s until she was put on statins in her 80s. What can other children do? You know, how do you put this together? When it doesn't all quite fit together, that's the real life question. It's not
the pure
science when you're controlling all the variables.
Well, that's the tough part about genetics. our understanding is rapidly evolving, but it's still very limited, and we don't know all the genetic components to this. And there are unfortunate things that can happen even outside of a genetic environment to cause an early or premature heart attack. It's basically just one of those things we use as a marker to identify risk in patients. And it, it, basically puts the radar up so that we're very aggressive in trying to figure out why and treat that accordingly, or just make sure we're aggressive with what they have, with what risk factors they have.
Is this plaque formation an inevitable component of aging?
As we age, we definitely will develop plaque. I don't think there, it's hard to demonstrate this, but I doubt there are very many 80-year-olds out there without any coronary plaquing. So it's clearly age-related. Age is an easy thing to measure, and it's probably of the things we can measure the strongest predictor for heart disease.
Tell us some more about the Healthy Hearts program that your Alaska Heart Institute and Providence have instituted. What's the patient you're looking for? Who do you want to make sure knows you're there and should take advantage of what's going on?
That's a great question. So we're trying to address primary prevention. So again, we're trying to find those people who have not been diagnosed with heart disease. And we're trying to find those people that would benefit really from a risk stratification. Now, if we know somebody is low risk and their risk is zero, meaning they really have no risk factors for heart disease, there's no high blood pressure, cholesterol is okay, they're not a smoker, there's no diabetes, there's no family history, then they're at low risk. And this program, although educational, is probably less bang for them as it might be for somebody who is in more of an intermediate risk category, which is where the risk scoring, I think, is probably most helpful. We know we define high risk as greater than 20% chance of having a heart attack in 10 years. Low risk is less than 10%. And then that intermediate risk, which unfortunately most of our patients fall into, is that risk where we're really trying to identify, are they closer to low risk or closer to high risk? And that's where doing risk assessment, we can actually calculate something we call Framingham risk score to figure out what their risk is over 20 years of having a heart attack on the basis of traditional risk factors. And then we combine some newer technologies, some blood testing called a C-reactive protein, which is a marker of inflammation that, if elevated, may place patients at risk for heart disease, and coronary artery calcium scoring, which is a marker for atherosclerosis or plaque formation, that also may be a marker for somebody who's at higher risk. And then these patients, after all this testing is performed, they meet in consultation with a cardiologist from an educational perspective and then to review the specifics and help kind of tailor therapy for each individual patient. And then they meet with an exercise physiologist to develop some tools and strategies for exercise that works for each individual patient. And then the dietitian will address kind of general dietary needs specific to that patient too. So say their triglycerides are high, they'll talk about kind of reducing the fat intake. If they're if they drink, more than three or four drinks a day, reducing alcohol intake, and then trying to get them on the right plan for weight loss.
Those of you who are listening to this and would like to get in touch or find out more, you can just go to our website, kska.org/line1, and we have a link to the Healthy Hearts program at the Alaska Heart Institute, and there'll be a phone number on that as well. So you're out there trying to find those increased risk individuals and individually look at their risk and try to affect that risk over time.
Correct. I think a lot of the problems with these risks is that they're asymptomatic. So if somebody's blood pressure isn't elevated, but it's not extremely elevated, they may have no symptoms. They may be walking around and not know it. Mm-hmm. Their cholesterol may be high, and you don't have symptoms from a high cholesterol. You don't think slower. You don't do other things that would be affected. And so by trying to tease out these different risks and individuals, we can then develop strategies that can be employed earlier, because all of these risk factors, the chronicity of such, contribute to heart disease over time. That's why that kind of age-related phenomenon is probably so prominent, is that if somebody's had untreated blood pressure for years, that effect is then even more dramatic. And by reducing that and reducing it earlier, we hope that people will then have fewer events in their lifetime.
We've got, maybe 2 minutes left, and I like to sum up with kind of an overview, you know, just hammer home the important points again. So let's do that, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, I think the most important is that if people feel they're at risk to seek medical attention and at least discuss with their primary care physician. And the risk factors we talked about, again, family history, age, diabetes, hypertension, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol, and smoking. And then once that assessment's done, realize that the strategies that will be employed will try and reduce that overall risk, but it can't reduce it to zero. Mm-hmm. So really kind of keeping a close eye on how we manage things, and really importantly from a lifestyle perspective, because I think that's what most of us, including myself, struggle with, is finding the time for ourselves to really address exercise and dietary goals to reduce this risk over time.
You know, one, we've just got a minute or so, and it just pops in my mind. Another thing that we hear so much about is stress, and we have not mentioned stress. You want to comment briefly on your belief or the science as you see it on stresses related to heart disease?
You know, I think it's clearly a contributor. Okay. And the problem with stress is it's not like blood pressure. We can't say our stress level is 125 over 73. Mm-hmm. And so that's where a lot of the testing, and there have been actual studies looking at using antidepressants in heart disease patients, and they've shown some marginal improvements. So, you know, I think in certain individuals, it probably does play a role. The difficult part is it's hard to measure how much stress and how people internalize that stress.
Or is it a confounding variable? I mean, if you're less stressed, you don't eat as much, maybe exercise more, and
Right, but if you're more stressed, you might exercise more if you're type A. So, and there is an association with type A and heart disease. So that is a really complicated problem to really have an easy solution for is stress.
Well, listen, it's been a pleasure. Thanks very much for taking the time. And more importantly, thanks for starting this preventative cardiology clinic. It sounds like it's a wonderful community access.
Great. Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I learned a lot. I got to kind of go out and come see you, I guess. Here. All right, so Line 1's going to return next week with Dr. Jeffrey Cabot. He is an epidemiologist at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He's a little bit concerned about how health information is getting disseminated and that it may be twisted and turned a little bit and affected by some biases. So why don't you listen next week, and we'll be discussing his book, Hyping Health Risks, Environmental Hazards in Daily Life, and the Science of Epidemiology. Pat Yak is vice president of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, your health connection, is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network and by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. Stroke is an emergency. Providence Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headaches without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence Alaska Medical Center. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.